Welcome to the Personal Computer Show.
Today is July the 31st.
I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message.
Equifax will pay up to $700 million in compensation for data breach. If you're among the 147 million Americans who credit data was compromised in the 2017 Equifax data breach, you may be eligible for compensation. The Federal Trade Commission ruled this week that credit reporting agency Equifax will have to pay up to $700 million in individual compensation and civil penalties because of the hack. According to the Commission's online claims process, those whose personal information was exposed can get free credit monitoring for 10 years, 4 years via the three major credit bureaus, which is Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, and 6 years specifically through Equifax. If you already have credit monitoring, you can choose to receive $125. For those who had to spend time and money as a result of the breach, Equifax can provide larger sum up to $20,000. According to the FTC, those losses can include unauthorized charges on your accounts, attorney or accountant fees, the cost of freezing or unfreezing your credit report, or the cost of credit monitoring. If you can provide documentation about your time spent grappling with a fallout of the data breach, you can get paid $25 per hour for up to 20 hours of personal time spent. You can file a claim through Equifax data breach settlement page. Equifax has a website where you can find out whether your personal information was exposed. The website is eligibility.equifaxbreachsettlement.com. That's eligibility.Equifax, EquifaxBreachSettlement.com. There's no spaces in there. The deadline to exclude yourself or opt out of the settlement process is November the 19th of this year, and all claims need to be filed by next year, January the 22nd. The data breach was the largest in history. In September 2017, Equifax disclosed that hackers had exploited a security flaw to gain access to the company's customer data. Sensitive information was exposed, including names, birth dates, driver's license numbers, social security numbers, and addresses. According to the settlement, Equifax will have to pay between $300 million to $425 million to the people whose data was exposed, and another $275 million in civil penalties to 48 states, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. FTC Chairman Joe Simon said companies that profit from personal information have an extra responsibility to protect and secure that data. Equifax failed to take basic steps that may have prevented the breach. The United States Department of Justice approves of Sprint and T-Mobile's U.S. merger. The Department of Justice, along with five state attorney generals, have cleared Sprint and T-Mobile U.S. to go ahead with a $26 billion merger of the two cellular networks, and T-Mobile U.S. to go ahead with a $26 billion merger the two cellular networks have been planning for years. They agreed to a settlement package with the two telcos that will allow them to ultimately clear the final regulatory hurdle and complete their merger. Sprint and T-Mobile have been kicking around the idea of a super merger since 2013 and have been officially pursuing it for more than a year. T-Mobile US CEO John Legere released the following statement. The T-Mobile and Sprint merger announced last April will create a bigger and bolder competitor than ever before, one that will deliver the most transformative 5G network in the country, lower prices, better quality, unmatched value and thousands of jobs, while unlocking an unprecedented $43 billion net of present value in synergies. We are pleased that our previously announced target synergies, profitability, and long-term cash generation have not changed. As part of the agreement, Sprint has agreed to sell off certain parts of its business to Dish Network, allowing the satellite carrier to enter the mobile space and fill the competitive void created by merging two national wireless providers. Under the terms of the deal, Dish Network would take over Sprint prepaid customers along with the Boost Mobile and Virgin Mobile brands, and additionally, Dish Network will get access to 20,000 cell sites and hundreds of retail locations owned by Sprint and T-Mobile US. Finally, T-Mobile has agreed to allow Dish Network to use its broadband network for the next 7 years in order to buy the new telco enough time to build out its own network. This will let Dish build using 5G hardware rather than worry about only supporting current generation devices. With this merger and accompanying divestiture, we are expanding output significantly by ensuring that large amounts of currently unused or underused spectrum are made available to the American consumers in the form of high-quality 5G network. That being said, the assistant AG with the Justice Department Antitrust Division said, the settlement will provide Dish Network with the assets and transitional services required to become a facilities-based mobile network operator that can provide a full range of mobile wireless services nationwide. Not everyone is so happy with the deal. The Center for Democracy and Technology said that it doesn't believe Dish will be able to step in and provide a true alternative for Sprint. The notion that Dish Network, which has talked about building a wireless network, but has been sitting on valuable wireless spectrum for years without doing anything with it, will promptly restore competition is fanciful. We all benefit when we have competition and choices, and the Department of Justice is falling down on the job by not protecting American consumers from this unprecedented market concentration in wireless services. Regardless, the Justice Department approval helped pave the way for the deal to become official, as the FCC granted its blessing back in May. While no date has been announced for the mega merger to be completed, T-Mobile US said that it expects the transaction to close before the end of the year. 13 state attorney generals led by New York AG remain unhappy with the supermerger and are suing to halt the merger deal. They can temporarily or permanently block the proposed transaction, and if they successfully convince the courts to weigh in. It is noted that the companies only needed the approval of the Department of Justice and at least 16 of the 19 required state public service commissions. They did receive approval from both. It should be noted that approvals received included the New York Public Service Commission, which is contrary to the New York State AG. VLC Media Player is a software designed to play back videos and audio. It supports a wide range of formats, including MPEG-4, DivX, and WAV files. It is also able to convert between various media formats and gives users the option to customize several aspects of their videos, like bandwidth, cropping, image rotating, and sound equalizing. VLC used to stand for Video LAN Client when VLC was a client of the Video LAN project. But since VLC is no longer merely a client, that initialism no longer applies. Well, why did I bring this up? Because I use it and many other people use it. But just the other day, German security agency CERT-BUN via WinFuture found a new flaw in VLC and is listed as CVE-2019-13615, and has been given a base vulnerability score of 9.8, which classifies it as critical. The vulnerability allows for remote code execution, which potentially allows bad actors, attackers, to install, modify, or run software without authorization, and could also be used to disclose files on the host system. Translation: VLC's security hole could allow hackers to hijack your computer and see your files. WinFuture reporting that Windows, Linux, and Unix versions of VLC are all affected, but not the macOS version. VideoLAN is also aware of the issue and is currently working on a patch, though right now that patch appears to be only 60% complete. Sadly, that means while people are waiting for a fix, your only recourse to protect yourself from the flaw is to uninstall VLC and switch to an alternative like KM Player or Media Player Classic. You've been warned. Google is testing controversial Google Assistant update. The fight for supremacy in the virtual assistants market is heating up. Google Assistant is testing major update that could elicit security concerns. As part of a proposed beta update, Google wants to make it possible for Google Assistant to send messages even from a locked device. Virtual assistants capable of offering high levels of convenience are in demand. The ability to use a device even with a locked screen will take convenience to another level. Google is positioning itself in the global intelligent virtual assistant market. Data by Zine Market Research indicates that the intelligent virtual assistant market will grow 35.4% between 2019 and 2025. The global virtual assistant in 2018 was $2.3 billion, and it is projected it will be $19.6 billion this year. Google is battling for market share against the likes of Amazon's Alexa, Microsoft's Cortana, and Apple's Siri. Privacy and security concerns with virtual assistants. Investments in smart homes have also given rise to smart speakers. Consequently, Google with Google Home finds itself in fierce competition with Amazon devices. However, the integration of virtual assistants in devices is increasingly stirring up privacy concerns. The lack of confidentiality of data and passive listening involved with smart devices is a major point of concern. A study carried out by Microsoft indicates that people are uncomfortable in sharing their data with internet companies. In addition to privacy concerns, Google is yet again evoking security concerns with a new update on Google Assistant by locking devices. People essentially try to block other people from accessing whatever is inside. However, that won't be entirely possible with a new beta update on Google Assistant. Google is yet to roll out the new Google Assistant beta update to all people. However, it will be interesting to see if a feature that allows users to turn off Google Assistant will come into play. It would also be interesting to see if the likes of Amazon, Microsoft, and Apple will unveil a similar feature. Google to pay $13 million over privacy lawsuit. The last thing that Google needs is issues with Google Assistant. The company is under immense regulatory scrutiny over the way it handles people's data and information. Similarly, the company has had to settle a privacy lawsuit that threatened to cost it billions of dollars. Google is to pay $13 million to settle claims it broke federal wiretapping laws by accessing people's information without consent. Under the project, Google used cars to photograph neighborhoods as part of a street mapping project. However, the company found itself in trouble on claims that the cars ended up gathering people's email and password. Court filings indicate that Google engineers knowingly built software to intercept additional information. Claims that the engineers did it intentionally are one of the reasons why the company is at a crossroads with regulators. In 2013, a court order ruling forced Google to pay $7 million to settle a similar case brought up by 38 states. The company did agree to destroy the additional information collected as part of the settlement as well. The company also agreed to teach people how to protect their information while using public Wi-Fi. Fast forward to today. Google is to pay $13 million upon approval by a judge to settle the decade-long lawsuit. A good chunk of the fine includes money relief for 22 plaintiffs. The remaining amount is to go towards 8 organizations focused on data privacy and consumer protection. The $13 million fine is a slap on the wrist, however, for Google, as the Street View project affects the tens of millions of people. The company can heave a sigh of relief as regulatory fines are piling pressure on its earnings. For starters, Google is to pay $1.7 billion to settle claims that engage in illegal advertising practices in Europe. In 2018, it was the subject of a record $5 billion fine over Android antitrust violations in Europe. Google is also trying to overturn a $2.7 billion fine over claims it engaged in anti-competitive practices on search results. However, it's not the only company under regulatory scrutiny over the way it handles people's data and information. Likewise, Facebook is the subject of a $5 billion fine over privacy breaches in relation to how it handles people's data. The $5 billion fine stems from the company's action that resulted in the exposure of 87 million users' information. The record fine comes amid calls that regulators need to do more to ensure accountability for tech companies. Twitter is another company under scrutiny and privacy and data security concerns. However, the company is yet to attract a hefty fine, as in the case with the other internet giants. Walmart and Nordstrom are building stores that don't sell anything. Traditional brick-and-mortar stores alone are not enough to stay ahead in the digital era. America's shoppers want convenient, hassle-free experiences, so Walmart and Nordstrom are building physical stores that don't actually sell anything. The two retailers are creating small hubs in big cities and dense suburban areas for shoppers to retrieve their online grocery and clothing orders. These new locations give them access to shoppers who want their stuff in a hurry without schlepping out to regular big box stores or waiting around for home delivery. Earlier this month, Walmart opened Walmart Pickup Point, a 40,000 square foot prototype store outside of Chicago in Lincolnwood, Illinois, to cater to customers' online pickups and deliveries. Customers drive up to the site to designated parking spots, and a Walmart worker will load up their trunk with their order. The inside of a Lincolnwood location looks like a typical Walmart with groceries and everyday items such as diapers, household cleaners, and pet supplies. Unlike a traditional Walmart supercenter, however, customers won't be able to go inside. It is also testing a similar model near its Arkansas headquarters. The new location gives busy customers the ability to shop how, when, and where they want. The new Walmart locations share similarities with Nordstrom Local, a concept Nordstrom first introduced in Los Angeles in 2017. Nordstrom Local hubs are smaller than its traditional department stores. They give customers a place to make pickups and returns and take advantage of Nordstrom's alteration and tailoring services. Nordstrom has 3 local stores in Los Angeles and is slated to open its first 2 in New York City in September. Walmart and Nordstrom innovations are the latest example of how retailers are attempting to create distinctive services to fight off Amazon. Retailers have been successfully expanding online pickup options in their stores in recent years. Nordstrom offers pickup at all its more than 100 full-price locations around the United States, while Walmart is on track to offer pickup at more than 3,000 of its stores by the end of 2019. Walmart Pickup Points and Nordstrom Local are another way these retailers are trying to capitalize on the growth of pickup, especially among younger and wealthier shoppers. More than 15% of U.S. shoppers have already tried online pickup, and sales will hit $35 billion annually by next year. Curbside pickup is the natural evolution of the traditional in-store shopping experience. Before we begin with our special segments, Marty Winston has a heat alert and its effect on the equipment you have.
Hey, is it hot? Has it been hot? Batteries. Batteries age more quickly, they discharge more quickly, and they are more likely to leak in sustained hot weather. That's especially, not only, but especially true when those batteries are in devices outdoors, like the outdoor part of an indoor-outdoor thermometer or the battery in a doorbell button. Batteries left in devices that are kept in cars, like flashlights, are also vulnerable. My advice? Check them.
Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his continuing IT Pro Series on voice assistance in the workplace.
Technology in the workplace is just amazingly abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to cover how work technology and personal technology are kind of mixing with each other. Now, we know that if I call out something like, "Hey Siri," that my phone will start responding to me. It just did, actually. And it will answer whatever question I might pose to it. We can do that with, of course, a number of different software packages, like Cortana and things like that. It's all over the place. Voice-activated technology is amazing. Whether we're talking to our Amazon Echo, or we're talking to some other various form of voice activation, it's enabling us to do so many different things. Now, this is something that is newer technology in the grand scheme of things. We have only had this really, we've only embraced it in the last, 4 or 5 years. But where is this going? Well, businesses are starting to take advantage of this, at least as far as managers are. We're starting to place all of these voice searches out there, looking for different ways to leverage the data that we have. And this is going to be moving further and further into the business realm. Now, we've dealt with the Internet of Things. We've dealt with, you call out Alexa, turn on the lights, Alexa, do this, whatever it is. And we've moved in the direction of turn up the volume on the radio, the television. We can change the channel via voice. But now let's apply this to business. As we move in, we start using Cortana. We can start utilizing different voice commands to print the document we're dealing with. I just hit Control P. I'm not a fan of the idea of talking to my computer, especially in an office where there's another, 20 people within earshot. Am I going to be annoying them? Are they going to be making commands to print the document and it actually starts printing the document I'm working on? It's something we're going to find out. We're going to have to figure this out. This detection of our language, our natural spoken language, is starting to creep into some very interesting areas. One of the things that I predicted a while back was that we would, this is back before we had the iPhone, back before we had smartphones, I had a personal digital assistant. It was a Palm Pilot. And I was in a conversation with somebody one day, and I said, at some point in time, we're going to be there, and we're going to have these personal digital assistants, all of us, and we'll be able to set up different conversations. We'll just have a conversation, you and me. We'll be sitting there, and we'll say, hey, let's talk about this over dinner sometime this next week. And our phones would communicate. They'd be listening to us, and they would communicate to each other, and they'd say, hey, let's set up various options. Next Tuesday sounds good? Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. And they would set up everything, including setting up where we would normally want to meet for dinner or lunch or whatever it is that was going on. Meet for coffee. Sure. This is something that we're going to start seeing in the very near future. We have the power. We have the capability of doing exactly this. Now, when I made that comment, when I had that conversation, that was 24 years ago or so. It's taken a long time to get here. It's taken a long time for us to bring speech recognition this far. But we're looking at almost 85% of all mobile devices are going to have voice-activated technology, this native speech recognition, in the next year. That's what we're looking at. Basically, by 2020, we're looking at 85% coverage. At that point in time, we're going to be able to make a number of different commands of set up a meeting with John, create a PowerPoint that will cover our profit and loss statements. Some of these different things are going to take longer to develop. They're going to take an immense amount of computing power and energy to do this. But some of the things that we've seen in science fiction, some of the different ideas that you might imagine that were far off, that were years and years away, 400 years off in Star Trek. Yeah, you get the idea. They're actually going to be available a lot sooner. Now, I'm not somebody to make recommendations in regards to the stock market or anything like that. But one of the areas that's most exciting for me, the one of the areas that I'm watching to see where we're going to go with this, is actually voice-activated technology. All of these different related items, we're at the cusp of seeing something amazing and grand. And yet, I'm sure whatever the end result is, whatever we wind up with at the end, will still be something that none of us really expected. In the meantime, we all need to get used to talking to our different bits and pieces of technology. We need to embrace this. We need to encourage them, because the future is bright. The future is listening to us, quite literally, right now, as we yell out, "Hey, Alexa." This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Digital technology has enabled the photographer to take pictures that previously were either technically not possible with conventional film cameras or only possible with high-end professional or customized equipment. Now we can record panoramic images inside the camera, slow-motion sequences, extremely short exposure pictures like catching a falling drop of water, focus after the picture has been taken, facial recognition, and body-worn video, also known as body cam. You do not have these features typically available on a smartphone, but they are available and affordable with digital cameras within the means of the average consumer electronics buyer. By that I mean the cost being under $1,000. Another camera frontier to be available on consumer cameras will be time-lapse photography. This is much more demanding, as the camera must be able to continuously be on to photograph images over an extended span of time. An example would be seeing images in the night sky with moving stars. Another example might be recording the opening bloom of a flower. Such a camera for time-lapse photography has a different design requirement. It has to have battery power to take a series of pictures continuously over hours or days. Battery power would enable the unit to be portable and not tethered to a set location for power. It needs to be set up and mounted on various surfaces. It needs to be weather-resistant to withstand the changes in the weather outdoors. And the ability to record images in virtually any type of light, from low light to intense backlight. Optionally available on the plus side would be, ideally, it can be manipulated remotely to zoom in and zoom out. The unit needs to have automatic focus as well as manual focus. It would be nice to create images with high definition 1080p time-lapse video. Is such a unit available today? The short answer is a qualified yes. For the past week, I've been testing the Aphitis ATL200. It is a time-lapse camera, and it meets the basic requirements I've outlined. It is well-built, and the recording format is MP4. My initial reaction to the design was the awkwardness inserting and removing the micro SD storage card. I had to have my 7-year-old granddaughter with small hands to do this for me. The alternative is to use Wi-Fi to transmit the data, but this process takes time. On the other hand, this is probably the same amount of time needed to fuss around with the micro SD flash card storage. But I realized that placing it in the space occupied by the battery was necessary for this awkwardness if you want the unit to be weather resistant. The unit was tested in the brutal heat that we have had in New York City. The unit held up. The physical unit is shaped like a small cube and it is well built. The image quality was quite impressive. The unit has an image alignment mode to reset position if the camera was moved or you had to move the camera or changing batteries. I have an Android smartphone to download the software app. The user experience with the app is that it is clunky and slow. Documentation for the unit does not exist. It was lengthy and frustrating with trial and error trying to guess how to set up. This may have caused me to say that the software was clunky and slow. Is it thumbs up or thumbs down for the Aphitis ATL200? Because of the total lack of documentation, it is a recommended unit only if you have a need for a time-lapse recording and you have the time and patience to figure out how to set up and use the camera. For the less than technically knowledgeable, the lack of documentation is a deal breaker. The pricing of the Aphitis ATL200 is also a head scratcher. The manufacturer's suggested price is $449. If you go to Amazon, the unit is $499. However, if you did more than a cursory search, you will find it for sale at $389. Although somewhat tongue-in-cheek, the use of time-lapse camera should go well with recording the output from a 3D printer. I've asked Marty Winston to give me his 2 cents or perspective on the uses of time-lapse photography. Marty?
For those of you who may be unfamiliar with time-lapse cameras, I'll start with a very fast umbrella explanation, then go to, well, the kind of a laundry list of some of the uses that they're especially well-suited to perform. And let me begin by sharing some of the differences between editing standard video to create a time-lapse look and specifically using a time-lapse camera to do the shooting in the first place. One of the biggest differences is battery. While a time-lapse camera awakens itself to shoot, a standard video camera will have exhausted its battery while on the outside 4 hours, many of them in less than an hour. Another big difference is memory. HD video, rule of thumb, 3 to 4 gigabytes per hour. A time-lapse camera only uses memory during those intervals when it's shooting and nothing between those times. So here's a quick bottom line. It is extremely difficult to use standard video cameras to shoot time-lapse without a lot of babysitting of their batteries and their memory. Now, let's get into why you might want to use time-lapse. The simplest way to explain it? Time-lapse is like viewing life in fast-forward. For example, let's say you want to monitor a complex, day-long 3D printing job that keeps going wrong. Only you're not sure exactly or even approximately when, and you'll never fix it without knowing that. Would you rather sit through 12 hours of standard video or see it all in an hour? A time-lapse camera that shoots just 5 seconds every minute can bring you within a minute of knowing exactly when. Or, you know, shoot 1 second every 12 seconds. That brings you within 12 seconds, and you're still watching the whole thing in an hour. A good camera gives you a whole regular time-lapse camera, gives you a whole range of choices, and in every case, it's set and forget. No one has to sit and stare at the printer for 12 boring hours. The camera does that. Sometimes, the same activity can take on different purposes. For example, at a construction site, time-lapse can document the whole build. It will look like the building is growing out of the ground, and that's often useful for marketing. The very same video can help identify potentially dangerous safety violations happening at the build site. A store owner can use time-lapse to see the flow of customers through the store or to keep an eye on off-hour backdoor activities. A time-lapse that starts with a blank canvas and ends up with a finished painting is a quick way to visually introduce new artists to the process of painting. And the same applies to many other crafts and skills. You got chipmunks or squirrels in your attic? How and where did they get in? And you might ask the same kind of question when rain in your yard turns into water in your basement. Which of the neighborhood dogs is getting into your yard? What time, really, does the truck pick up the trash or the mail get delivered? Time-lapse gets you those answers. When there's a disaster, the disaster response team appropriately puts their focus on dealing with the crisis. Might there be a faster, better way to handle everything? For processes that take days to weeks, a time-lapse fast-forward review doesn't just save time. It makes flow issues more visible, and it helps managers understand which operations are overstaffed and which are overwhelmed. Power outages create monitoring problems for most cameras, but time-lapse cameras can run for weeks or longer on fresh batteries. The same for areas that become inaccessible because of floods or washouts. And at areas that are prone to floods or washouts, time-lapse is a wonderful way to understand exactly what happened, making it a challenge that's a little easier to solve a little sooner. Then there's training. Training has two faces, showing the right way to do things, and when things are being done the wrong way, identifying them early so they can be corrected. Most on-the-job training, OJT, relies on senior or specialized staffers making real-time observations, often of many workers at once. Add one or more time-lapse cameras, and it's a lot easier to identify how and where training can help. I think time-lapse cameras should be in the hands of every law enforcement agency, every training department, every disaster response team, tons of different kinds of service businesses, and lots of others. Maybe you. Me? I already have one. Like I said, time-lapse video is a great tool for watching life in fast forward.
Presenting Marty Winston, and he talks about recognizing the difference between storage and organization, with some ideas on both, like how to recognize if you're turning into a hoarder.
My longtime friend Al used to regularly exercise an activity that law enforcement guidelines tend to call scavenging. Scavenging. My dad, who was a child of the Depression experience, would call it curbside shopping. A little more romantic, a little friendlier. Al used to beat the trash trucks to the stops on their route and pick up almost anything electronic. TV sets, radios, phones, you name it. Al took those things home and examined them. Some could be repaired. He was good at that. And he would have something to use or to sell or to trade. Some that couldn't be repaired could be harvested for their parts. Components of all kinds. Vacuum tubes, speakers, picture tubes, you name it. The rafters of the ceiling in Al's basement were lined with cigar boxes and pipe tobacco tins and coffee cans, each labeled with something handwritten on a piece of masking tape. He used these to store the parts he would need for future repairs or his own projects. It was a supply that often let him do electronics work without spending a penny. Perhaps I should mention, Al's Scottish, very Scottish, and still a friend. There are three ways to view what Al would do: storing spare parts, or organizing parts, or hoarding. Before you cast your vote, spin the calendar up to now. It's several decades and several houses later, and he still has a lot of vacuum tubes stored away in his basement. Only these days, he's unlikely to ever need another one for any purpose. So, storing, or organizing, or hoarding. We all do some of each, but we're all, me and you and everybody else, all more likely to deal with our habits by rationalizing than by objectively analyzing. How many obsolete computer cables do you have put away just in case? How many little AC adapters were those barrel connectors that once went with products that you long ago threw away when they stopped working? How many remote controls for things you don't use around? How many blank disks, blank tapes, USB drives, SD cards, or headsets? How many speakers? How much hi-fi gear? That kind of hoarding starts with a phrase you either say to yourself or you say to explain how clever you are to save things. You never know when you'll need one of these. You'll never know when you'll need one of these. You never know. You know, that's another term for admitting you're ignorant. What if instead you say, you know you'll never need one of these? And really, you do know you'll never need one of these. How do you know? Come on. When's the last time you needed an AC adapter and you found one among the stuff you were hanging on to that actually really worked? Let's talk about those adapters, about their connectors. Lots of shapes, lots of sizes. If just matching those is how you choose to try one, you can fry whatever it is you're trying to keep running. You need the right voltage. It needs to deliver enough current. There are problems if the polarity doesn't match or if you try to hook AC to DC. Did you take the time to label each of them before you put it away? Do you take the time to test them when you need one? You know, if your time is worthless, that might be a good value. If your time is not worthless, you might be better off just abandoning the idea of saving them at all. It's certainly not all of them. Try this. If you ever, ever have a bad power adapter for a product that you still want to use and that's not still under warranty, buy it. Having said all that, I'll make a conditional exception. USB-connected power adapters have more ongoing relevance than the ones with barrel or prong connectors. Make sure you know which ones have special fast charge abilities like QC3, the older ones, and any that can only deliver, 500 milliamps or less of current, well, you can throw those away. Bring a flashlight and a magnifying glass to read the specs. You'll need them. USB has several plug shapes with names like Mini and Micro and A and B and C. Depending on how many adapters you don't discard, you may either want to sort them that way or label them. And that is where we transition from storing to organizing. I'll get into my own techniques for organizing in a moment, but first, let's consider that cluster of power adapters while you're still imagining it. For those that are consistent with the gear you use all the time, why are you storing them? In some cases, it might make sense to put them to work. You know, put one in the kitchen, one in the bedroom, one in the home office. Put one in the work office, one in the glove compartment. Stick one into that toiletry kit you take when you travel. And if you're clever, not just the power adapter, put a cable in with each one of them. Still have some left? Are you sharing with the spouse and the kids? Do that. Now, how many do you have left? If it's still more than three or four, busted, you're hoarding. Here are the guidelines. If you're just putting things away to get them out of the way, you're storing. If you put things away in a way that makes them easier to find and identify later, you're organizing. If you have more than you'll ever use, and that number might be one, if you have more than you ever use, and if you keep more than you'll ever use, are you hoarding? Well, think of it this way. How many square feet is your home? How much do you pay every month to live there? How many of those square feet get eaten up by storage? Do the math. Either the things you store, remember, they're not paying rent. Either the things you store are costing you money or they're stealing elbow room from your living space. Well, sorry about the lecturing. We're all in denial about our hoarding habits, yeah, including me. So let's talk about organizing. One of my biggest challenges is different kinds of cables. For a while, I got some of those plastic rollabout stacks of drawers that crafters use, and I sorted my cables into those. The drawers filled quickly. Start over. I made a small mountain of all the cables of each type. Mountain of USB, mountain of HDMI, and one of Ethernet, and so on, one at a time. I surrounded myself with empty cardboard boxes and used a magic marker to label a visible flap on each box. One cable at a time, I would pull a cable from the pile and toss it into the appropriate box, sorting them out. Or, if the cable looked bad, I had a wastebasket waiting nearby, so it was a little bit of divide and conquer as the first step. My next step was to think about the cables that ended up in each of those boxes. Older cables, meaning cables that were for earlier standards, like USB 2 cables that had since been replaced by USB 3 cables and were now just just in case, spares? Well, those were obvious candidates for a population reduction. I thinned the collection and put those I culled into a box to donate to the local schools. Schools, that's where tech seldom advances quite as quickly and where wear and tear are a constant factor. It didn't take terribly long to winnow the mountain down to a fraction of its original size. I rolled the longer cables into coils and zip-tied them. If there were major categories like, USB 2 versus USB 3 versus USB-C, it isn't crazy to treat them separately depending on how many there are. That approach seems to work for cables. Almost every entertainment product comes with a remote control. I have a small tape-style label printer that I use to identify which remote control comes with which product, how they belong together. I put the label either on the back of the remote or inside the battery door. If the label doesn't fit, I also have a silver Sharpie that's visible on black plastic. For things like my TiVo peanut-shaped remotes that look the same everywhere, I could label both the remote and its companion TiVo mini box with a description of the TV set they're programmed to support. That's very helpful when you're moving. I should mention, never store remotes or anything without taking the batteries out. Okay, I have several ways of labeling things and a pretty good assortment of label printers. That's part of my approach to organizing. I also make ongoing decisions among my version of the three fates. Use, discard, or donate. Storing is not one of those choices. Just use, discard, or donate. That gives me a mindset that putting things into storage is like dooming them into limbo, at least for a while. Let me talk about places. I used to have a lot of books. I've donated all but a few, but I still have bookcases left, and those can be helpful. I was able to get a good number of empty wooden wine crates at a really cheap price. I added magnetic cabinet latches so their lids are easy to remove or replace. I can label them and line them up side by side on bookshelves, and that still leaves room on each shelf for a few more items. I use those wine crates to store, for example, camera accessories or portable recording gear or soldering supplies. I also got some small plastic case handle cases in different colors, the molded stuff, and those are handy for storing spare hard drives or small peripherals, and there's still room for the few books I kept. I gave away those plastic crafting carts and got just a few taller wooden equivalents, which are good for the cables that I still need to keep on hand. I also have a few cigar boxes that I can use to subdivide those drawers, and I got a replica wooden library file drawer unit. It's great for small parts, SD cards, or for discs. I have some stackable plastic ammunition boxes. I keep batteries in one of those, for example, drawing and drafting supplies in one, hardware and fasteners in one. I have two short wooden two-drawer files. One of them is dedicated to equipment manuals, sorted loosely by brand name. The other stuff, the usual filing stuff you're going to do. I have four small wooden treasure chests in a row on my credenza. My desk doesn't have drawers, and those chests hold what would usually be in drawers, things like business cards, paper clips, rubber bands, staplers, that kind of thing. I have several tackle boxes that I use to sort and keep things like connectors, Ethernet in one, coax in another, and room for a few associated tools and testers. They're also good for organizing my various passive electronic components. And I have one to hold my spare AC electrical connectors, meaning I can now cut power cords to the length they need to be without having to deal with all those spare feet of fat cables rolled into hanks. I think you get the idea. Classes of storage, culling of items, lots of labels. And remember, my three fates: use, discard, or donate. Next time, my subject is pipe dreams and nightmares. The pipes are your household water pipes. The dreams include getting hot water without waiting for it. The nightmares include sneaky ways they can cost you money all the time, not just when they leak water. I'll have the info on tap. Just be here to turn the faucet.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question.
All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. The amateur computer group has their general meeting Friday, August the 2nd. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, August the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and the presentation is How to Configure and Set Up a Home and Small Office Network. I will be giving that presentation. It will be at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, August the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Old Westbury campus of the New York Institute of Technology, otherwise known as NYIT or New York Tech, at the Harry J. Schur Hall. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, August the 13th, and the meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group meets Tuesday, August the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has no planned meeting for August, but they will meet September the 3rd at the Danbury Hackerspace, and their meeting time is 7 p.m. at 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. And we hope to see you at one of these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.